And warm welcome. You are listening to 100.5 CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. This is the Animal Voices Show, and we are about talking about animal advocacy and welfare and rights issues, and we believe in a world in which animals are granted the basic rights that humans take for granted. And my name's Alyssa. I'm joined in studio today by Jackie.
Hi.
And Allison on the controls.
Hey there.
And today, let's see, what do we have? We have a couple great interviews for you today with a Canadian focus. We're going to be talking to Shannon Cornelson of the Fur Bear Defenders, who's going to be talking about their new campaign, Fur Trim is a Trap. And this is the season, of course. We're out and about all bundled up in our winter gear, and I am seeing so much fur trim that it's really just appalling. And so, yeah, I wanted to talk to the Fur Bear Defenders about their new campaign. They have a new series of bus ads up all around Toronto. And we're also going to be talking to Cheryl Fink later in the show. She is the director of the SEAL program with the International Fund for Animal Welfare. And she's been researching about the SEAL issues in Canada for the last 10 years. And she is very opinionated on the recent decision of a National Senate Committee, a recommendation to kill or cull, as they call it, a huge number of gray seals in the Atlantic. So we're going to be talking to her later in the show. I thought this was a good time to mention, we're doing a bit of a review of Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau's new vegan challenge program called the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, and we do have a challenger who has stepped up to review the program for us, and we're going to be talking to him in January and learning more about the program. It's a multimedia online program created by Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, as I said, featuring premium written audio and video content to give you everything you need to support you on your journey towards optimal wellness and unconditional compassion. So my friend Paul has stepped up. He was a flexitarian who's interested in committing back to being a lifelong vegetarian or ideally vegan diet. He started the challenge at the beginning of November. I think it was November 6th or so. So he'll be wrapping up the official challenge program in December 6th. And I really look forward to hearing how he does over the holidays and how it changes his habits. Yeah, we'll have him on the show in January, and I just wanted to promote that. I thought it was a good time to mention it. And now I think we're going to talk about some events here. Jackie.
Yeah, we have some great events coming up. So actually this weekend on Sunday, that's December 2nd, from 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., City Centre Canada Line Station, Liberation BC will be handing out some holiday outreach at the Santa Claus Parade. So they'll be distributing the turkey leaflets, so with holiday recipes, just to let people know, you know, you don't have to eat turkey just because it's Christmas. So they'll be handing this out to parade goers as they arrive. Every year, this is one of their most successful leafleting events, and you can help. They'll provide all the leaflets, so all you need to bring is yourself, but be sure to dress warmly. For more information or any questions, please email roger@liberationbc.org.
Are you talking about Santa Claus Parade?
Yes.
Okay, and come out and watch me play in my band at the Santa Claus Parade. We'll be near the beginning.
It's a double event.
Nice.
All right. So also coming up... So in Vancouver, BC, they're going to be a screening of Veggiecated. So that's a part sociological experiment and part adventure comedy. Veggiecated is an award-winning guerrilla-style documentary that follows three meat and cheese-loving New Yorkers who agree to adopt a vegan diet for 6 weeks. Obviously, this was a little bit challenging for them, but I think that it kind of proves the point of the health benefits. So this is lured by tales of weight loss and health regained. They begin to uncover the hidden sides of animal agriculture and soon find themselves risking everything to expose an industry they supported just weeks before.
Have you seen the film, Jackie?
I haven't, and I really want to go to this. Unfortunately, I work crazy hours, so I'm going to try to sneak out of work early and make it, but...
if you can't make it, I have the DVD.
That would be great. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, it's really, really good. I've seen it, and I think it does a pretty good job of covering the animal issues as
and
well.
And I'm actually going to be organizing a public screening in the new year of Educated, so you can see it then,
lots of opportunities to watch this. So. This event is going to take place at the Irving K. Barber Learning Center at 1961 East Mall at UBC in room 156, and that's in Vancouver. And this is Monday, December 3rd from 5 to 7 p.m. So if you can make it, I strongly suggest you do. And another thing on Sunday, there's going to be an evening called Veg Simplicity, Veg Diplomacy with vegan registered dietitian Vicento Molina. And this will take place at Eternal Abundance Restaurant at 1025 Commercial Drive in Vancouver. So join the staff at Eternal Abundance for an informative and tasty evening with well-known vegan dietitian and author Vicento Molina. With the holidays approaching, it's especially important to learn easy, tasty ways to fit health-supportive foods into busy lives. Vicento Molina will help you come up with new, simple ideas for nutritious breakfasts, lunches, dinners, and snacks on vegan and raw food diets and celebration meals that everyone will enjoy, as well as consider how to navigate through the holiday season and celebrate. So you have no excuses to eat meat over the holiday season. And this is also for family and friends whose dietary patterns, you know, differ from your own, just to help encourage them towards a vegan lifestyle. So entry fee is $10 and includes organic, raw, and vegan snacks.
And now I guess it's time for our first interview. Since 1944, the Association for the Protection of Fur-Bearing Animals, also known as Fur Bear Defenders, have been working to end the commercial fur trade by exposing, trapping cruelty, and through protecting fur-bearing animals in the wild or in confinement. Shannon Cornelson is based in Toronto, and she joins us today by phone to talk about their new campaign, Fur Trim is a Trap. Thanks so much for joining us today, Shannon.
Oh, no problem. Thanks so much for asking us.
Definitely our pleasure. We, as I said at the beginning of the show, we're just seeing fur more and more in the season, and I really wanted to feature it on the show. So can you tell us about your new campaign and your hopes about its reach?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Fur Trim is a Trap is our winter 2012 campaign, and it has several different components which we sort of strategically plan to be reaching people in various sort of ways. So we've got actually a Toronto subway ad campaign running right now. We have silent vigils that are actually happening all over the country. We have a Fur Never fashion party, which is coming up next Friday, December 7th in Toronto. We have Leanne Miley Highgard of Vogue Couture, that really awesome vegan fashion company. She's going to be coming to show off her winter line and sort of prove how amazing, compassionate fashion can actually be. We have really awesome campaign literature. We have two postcards this year, one that's for people wearing fur and one that's for people who aren't wearing fur. And we decided to use a lot of the concepts of positive sort of reinforcement to turn would-be fur purchasers or possible fur purchasers into steadfast anti-fur people simply by thanking them for not wearing fur. So anyway, it's a really exciting campaign. We've got lots of grassroots organizing happening, and we actually have a National Day of Convergence coming up on December 22nd, where we're anticipating anywhere between 30 to 40 groups from across the country are going to protest against Canada Goose, who definitely is leading the charge in terms of this resurging fur trim population. And you can get tons of information about the campaign details on furtrimisatrap.com, so I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, for sure, and I'll post that on our blog. I did hear a glimmer of, yeah, an event on December 22nd in Vancouver, in Carisdale, actually. I think there's a, is it called Canada Goose? Is that the name of the store?
It's the name of the retail, like the company,
yeah.
And so they're carried at various retailers across the country.
Okay, yeah, we'll keep our listeners up to date with that and make sure to get everyone out there on that day. And so I want to just talk about fur. People have different sort of misconceptions, and there's a lot of myths out there, and I think people even who believe in animal welfare and care of animals don't exactly know all the details. So I just wanted to first talk about about this fur trim and where it comes from. So first, what percentage of fur sold in Canada is wild trapped versus farmed?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Actually, more than 75% of the fur in Canada actually comes from fur farms. And I'm not sure how much your listeners know about fur farming, but fur farming, just like any other form of factory farming, is literally hell on earth for animals. So the commonly farmed fur animals in Canada are mink and fox. And, you know, mink have a natural territory of up to 2,500 acres, and foxes roam even more space in their natural environment. And despite that, these animals spend their, you know, horribly miserable lives trapped in tiny wire cages stacked together in long sheds. They eat, they sleep, they go to the bathroom in these cages. It's really a horrible life for them. In fact, to give context, the average mink in Canada has less than 2 sheets of paper in terms of space. And this is for an animal that naturally has a territory of 2,500 acres. You know, they're denied access to water, and studies have shown that because mink are semi-aquatic, this has serious welfare impacts. Foxes have also shown that they have a similar effect when they're denied the ability to dig and seek cover. Obviously, tiny wire cages don't allow for that sort of behavior. So the result is, you know, some really, really sad physical consequences, as well as some sort of more common psychological conditions that we see in farmed animals and things like that as well. So 75% are coming from these poor animals who have short, miserable lives on fur farms. The other 25% comes from wild trapping.
Wow. We can talk a bit about trapping in a minute. I just want to, I think most people probably think there's humane regulations about these fur farms. Can you just talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always very happy to do some myth busting. Okay, so what you'll hear the fur industry say, or the Fur Council of Canada, is that they abide by the recommended codes of practice for the care and handling of farm animals, which includes mink and ranched fox. And they'll say that they were developed by Agriculture Canada in collaboration with the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies. And to the average person, that sounds like, okay, there are regulations in place, but don't let the rhetoric fool you. There are no laws regulating the keeping, handling, or killing of cage-raised fur-bearing animals in Canada. All the regulations are entirely voluntary and simply reflect the standard practices that are used to make the most possible money off of each animal with the least possible amount of input and care. And again, if you go to our website, there's more information about this, but that's a common thing we hear is, well, there are welfare standards. They're voluntary.
People need to realize that it's always about money. Money is the bottom line. People aren't doing this to act in the interest of the animals, or
it's all money and politics,
or else they would be doing it.
And actually, to build on that, one thing you'll also commonly hear the industry say is that it's in the best interest of the farmers to treat their animals well, because it's integral to the quality. Because it's integral to the quality of the fur. But that's actually not true. High quality fur has never ever been shown to reflect the actual health or well-being of an animal. And it actually often is only because they're killed shortly after their first winter coat arrives, which is at about seven months. So that's another common sort of soundbite you'll hear, that we really need people out there debunking and challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk a bit about the other sort of approximately 25% that comes from wild trapping. There is another myth pushed by the fur industry that that kind of cruelty is part of our heritage here in Canada, and that the fur trade is still integral to the survival of Indigenous communities. Can we talk a bit about just trapping and the cruelty there?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is obviously a big one, and we're a little limited for time, so I'll give you guys basically a primer that I like to sort of share with people. So first of all, less than 2% of Canada's Indigenous population is involved in the commercial fur trade. Less than 2%. The Indigenous people who are employed in the lowest paying sector of the trade, which is the actual trapping itself. They enjoy less than 1% of the total profits of the commercial fur trade in Canada. So any argument that it's necessary for the sustainability of Indigenous livelihoods is just lip service. It's just a selling feature. It's not the reality. So that's sort of what we really want people to know when we talk about the Indigenous angle. Pardon me. In terms of it being a part of our heritage, if you go to our website, we talk a little bit about the actual history of the fur trade in Canada. And as much as they'd love everyone to think that they have this long history of stewardship, that's just not actually the case. In fact, the beaver, which sort of became like the official iconic emblem of Canada, was almost trapped to extinction. And it was only due to the writings of, Grey Owl, I'm sorry. I'm just a little bit brain dead right now. He actually was the person who inspired the conservation efforts that came on board and then saved the beaver. There's tons of examples like this in Canada's fur trade history as well as the fur trade history abroad. So that's sort of an important thing to consider.
Yep.
And then in terms of the claims about humane trapping, I can also comment on that if you want.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so pretty much one of the things that a lot of Canadians don't know is that the term humane is not regulated in any way. It has no official bearing on what a product does or doesn't do. Canada's Competition Act doesn't restrict the use of it, is another way of saying that. So they capitalize off the emotional weight that Canadians feel for this term without actually having to do anything. The Fur Council of Canada are usually the ones who are behind the whole, you know, humane trapping thing, but they're actually just the marketing body of the fur industry. They represent the industry. They have absolutely no legal authority. So them saying that something is humane does not make it humane. And one of the best examples we have is that the leg hold trap, which is illegal in several countries, is still legal here. And animals can suffer in these traps for days across Canada, and for kill traps, the check times are even less frequent. So theoretically, an animal can be trapped in a kill trap for up to 2 weeks without being dispatched, which is the industry term for killed. And that's not acceptable. That's not humane, and that's not something that we believe the majority of Canadians would be comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. That's great to know. Thanks for shedding light on that. Now, I want to bring it to fur trim, which is probably more common out on the streets than, say, a fur coat.
Sure.
I think a lot of people think that fur trim is just a byproduct. Let's debunk that myth and talk a bit about the problems with fur trim.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so yeah, you're totally bang on. It's not a byproduct. It's definitely not socially acceptable anymore to wear full-length fur coats. So the industry could either collapse or reinvent themselves. And so what they did is they've managed to sneak fur trim onto all sorts of garments, boots, accessories, toys, etc. And so the majority of animals killed in Canada are killed for fur trim, not full-length coats. It's not a byproduct. And that's definitely an important thing to sort of debunk. Now, I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with the dog and cat fur issue.
Yeah, actually, 2 years ago, we did an interview with a representative from Fur Bears about the dog and cat issue, but it was 2 years ago, and let's get into it again. We have about 4 minutes.
Okay, awesome. So the dog and cat fur issue, simply put, in 2008, the EU banned the import and sale of dog and cat fur. The U.S. banned it in 2000. And Canada, the Conservative government, has indicated that they are not interested in banning this at all. So as it stands, it's perfectly legal to import and sell dog and cat fur in Canada, which is horrifying to most Canadians. So approximately 2 million dogs and cats are slaughtered for their meat and fur in China, Taiwan, and the Philippines every year. The cat and dog meat sold at the market, and the animal skins and fur are used to create a variety of products that are shipped all over the world, including to Canada. Unfortunately, Canada's Conservative government has no intention of banning it, as it would negatively impact trade with China, who just so happens to be the biggest buyer of Canada's seal skins. Because of the labeling laws in Canada, manufacturers and retailers don't have to identify a product as containing dog or cat fur. under the law, only certain products have to be permanently labeled, and even when they're permanently labeled, they only have to say fur fiber, not the specific animal.
Hmm.
And in addition to that, the Competition Bureau states that boots, shoes, slippers, handbags, toys, ornaments, pet accessories can use real fur, dog, cat, mink, etc., and not label it. So even the garments that do require a label, due to like the widespread disapproval, the Asian fur industry has revealed time and time again that they will intentionally mislabel fur. Producers of fur in China will sew any label onto a product if it makes it more easily. So there are examples of dog being sold as Asian wolf, while cat is often sold as rabbit or mink. And while these are all horrifying, you can see how the average person who maybe has more of an affinity for cats and dogs is being duped into making these purchases as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that there's currently a bill on the table. The people probably want to support. Can you tell us
absolutely.
A quick bit about that?
Yep. So Libby Davies, she's an NDP MP from Vancouver East, introduced Bill C-296 in 2011. If this bill is passed, it would ban the import and sale of dog and cat fur and make the labeling of fur products mandatory, so people would finally know or be forced to reckon with what animal they're wearing when they're purchasing fur. To sort of support the bill, we urge people to contact their member of parliament, asking them to support it. We also have petitions that are available for download off of our website, which is furbearerdefenders.com. And we encourage people to print them off, hit the street, get out there. Let's keep this bill alive, because it's a great opportunity to end the dog and cat fur, you know, industry in Canada as we know it.
Excellent. Yeah, again, that's Bill C-296. So show your support for that. I have to wrap it up now. That was a basic 101 of fur and fur trim in Canada. Thank you so much for your time, Shannon.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
I did want to mention now another primary myth is that fur is eco-friendly and natural. We don't have much time today, as I said, but we did do a little special feature on this of April of 2012, and I will link to it on our blog. How can we stay warm in winter without contributing to animal suffering? Well, just probably best to avoid anything that looks like fur. It's too hard to tell sometimes unless your eye is really trained for it, and it also promotes that as fashion. And let's keep educating people. So furtrimisatrap.com.
Local BC band Falco and Monashi.
So I have some news for you now. So I'm not sure how many of you have heard about this, but there's going to be a downsizing of critical habitat for BC's Selkirk caribou. So a battle among U.S. environmentalists, snowmobilers, and state politicians has left Canada's southernmost caribou herd with only a fraction of the planned critical habitat area proposed a year ago by U.S. federal wildlife officials. So a proposed 375,000-acre protection zone announced last December for the tiny herd of just a few dozen animals living in the Selkirk Mountains was hailed by Canadian and American wildlife advocates at the time as an early Christmas present for the unique mountain-dwelling population of caribou. But now, bending to pressure from Idaho's Republican senators, snowmobile enthusiasts, and other groups concerned that the planned conservation zone was too large, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has finally approved a critical habitat of just 30,000 acres, which is less than a tenth of the original plan, in the U.S. stomping grounds of the cross-border caribou. But one U.S. conservation group promptly panned the plan as inadequate, and the final rule designates the habitat that was occupied when caribou were listed as endangered in 1983, Smith added. Unfortunately, this represents a habitat used by an imperiled herd rather than a recovered herd. More habitat must be protected to have a growing herd and achieve recovery. The mountain caribou inhabit only thick, high-elevation forests feeding primarily on tree lichen instead of the lichen ground cover consumed by their far more numerous woodland caribou cousins, which are spread across boreal Canada. So, again, you know, this is a similar... It's similar to all the culling and everything. It's just politics getting in the way and sacrificing wildlife for tourism. It's going to be a chronic problem, unfortunately, in Canada, it sounds like. And here's another story, again, related to politics and wildlife. So complaints by two farmers in California's Central Valley have sparked a U.S. review of whether southern resident killer whales should be removed from the endangered species list. The quirky link between California cotton and melon farmers and the 85 killer whales, which spend much of their year around the Strait of Georgia, Juan de Fuca Strait, and Puget Sound, is water for the Sacramento-San Joaquin River deltas. So the water is needed for salmon, the preferred diet of killer whales, so farmers with access to river water for irrigation has been limited. During the nine-month review, the association will seek public input before deciding whether to propose removal of the southern residents from the Endangered Species Act list. If there is a formal delisting proposal, it would be followed by public hearings before a final decision is made. The Pacific Legal Foundation is dressing it up as science, but it's way out of the consensus of geneticists. The group is anti-government, anti-environmental, and anti-regulation, Howard Garrett of Orca Network says. They just don't like our planet much at all. And Garrett said that he can understand how some people who have not studied whales can be confused by resident and transient orcas sharing the same habitat but never interbreeding. However, almost all scientific reviews classify them as distinct populations. Delisting advocates believe the genetic analysis is inadequate because it's based on markers from females, not males. If the killer whales were delisted in the U.S. and the recovery plan scrapped, it would not affect the Canadian designation, but the orcas constantly swim between Canadian and U.S. waters. So again, two stories of political interest overtaking wildlife.
I just wanted to mention, I saw in news today that urban decay, which has been one of the most well-known cruelty-free vegan makeup and body care companies, has been bought up by L'Oreal, which...
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess that
probably... Of course, they test on animals.
That doesn't mean that they're going to be... Because there was the controversy earlier this year in which Urban Decay wanted to put their market into China. All their supporters said, no, because China, they make animal testing mandatory. Mm-hmm. So then they went back and listened to their supporters and their consumers, and they went back to being an animal-free product. And now they're not again, it looks like. That's breaking news to me.
It is.
Are we having a song?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, that was the beginning of a song. Anyway, we'll play it at the end. So, let's get on to our feature interview here. Cheryl Fink works with the International Fund for Animal Welfare as the director of their seal program. She's observed the commercial seal hunt in Canada for 10 years, documenting and providing ongoing evidence of its cruelty. She's a frequent lecturer on seal hunting at conferences, drawing upon her experiences with IFA and her background as a biologist, having worked in the field with harp, hooded, and gray seals. She's also a regular invited speaker at public events to raise awareness of the cruelty inherent in the commercial seal hunt. So, Cheryl, the Standing Senate Committee on Fisheries and Oceans recently recommended a massive kill, or cull as they call it, of gray seals in the Atlantic in order to help fish stocks come back, I think. Can you give us a bit of background on this committee and how it came to be, and then we'll start unpacking some of the recommendations.
Okay, sure. Well, the committee has been looking at the issue of gray seals in Atlantic Canada for about a year now. And this is something that was requested by the Minister of Fisheries last summer. And we know that the fishing industry on the East Coast has been sort of complaining about gray seals and calling for a reduction in gray seal numbers for, gosh, almost 20 years now. Pretty much ever since the cod moratorium, we like to blame marine mammals and other predators for reductions in the fish when really we're the ones to blame. So the Senate committee was put together. They had a number of witnesses provide testimony over the course of the year. It started out a little bit rough. We were watching it every week, and a lot of the witnesses who appeared actually admitted they'd never seen a gray seal before and didn't know much about gray seals at all. There were a lot of witnesses who had experience with harp seals from the sealing industry and whatnot. And then finally, around February, we did start hearing some real testimony from scientists and from people who did have experience with gray seals. In particular, I guess Dr. David Levine, our own science advisor, appeared before the committee, as well as a group of scientists from Dalhousie University in Halifax, marine biologists. And they presented very interesting information that actually was against a cull of gray seals, very strong scientific testimony that a cull of gray seals would not help cod recovery in the southern Gulf of St. Lawrence. In spite of this, as you note, this past fall, the committee came out with a recommendation to kill 70,000 gray seals. We chuckled a bit in the press conference. They actually admitted that there was no scientific basis for a cull. It wasn't based on any solid research, but they were going to recommend it anyways, as the chair of the committee said. So I guess not much of a surprise coming from our government, but, you know, a very bold recommendation considering the complete lack of scientific evidence to support a cull of seals.
Mm-hmm. So I must admit, when I first heard this news, I was a little bit confused because I had a general understanding that there's a seal hunt going on for the last while. I'm pretty sure that includes gray seals. And can you just talk about the difference between, like, the seal hunt and this proposed cull?
Yeah. Generally, when I use the words hunt and cull, we think of a hunt as something that's done for perhaps a commercial purpose or something that's done, but in the context of maintaining a wild population at a stable level, whereas a cull is something deliberately designed to reduce a population of animals, to reduce their numbers, often with the intent that it might benefit another species, which is the case here. As you know, there are two separate species of seal on the East Coast that are hunted, and generally the large-scale hunt for seals, the commercial hunt, has been for harp seals, which is a different species, and that's a large-scale hunt with a quota of 400,000 animals. Gray seals, there's been attempts to hunt them and to market them commercially, but really not a lot of success. I think, according to the government records, no gray seals were taken as part of the hunt last year, and fewer than 500 in hunts in recent years. So not a lot of gray seals being killed, and this, I think, ties into the difficulties in finding markets for seal products in general these days. But specifically for gray seals, if you're looking at markets for fur, the gray seal fur is a little bit flatter, not as fluffier. So just for people who do buy fur and like fur, it's not as desirable a product as the harp seal fur.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the numbers here. What sort of quotas are there for the hunt, and how many seals are there out there, and how have they grown over the years?
The gray seal is a really interesting study because this is a population that we've depleted seriously over the past century. In the 1940s, it was at a point where gray seals were actually very rare to see. And, you know, by, sorry, it's not 1940s, 1960s, there were probably only 5,000 animals, according to some estimates. Despite this, we continued to have a bounty on gray seals, paying sealers for snouts of animals and later jawbones that were turned in. But the population did recover. We're looking at about 350,000 gray seals right now on the East Coast, which is not a huge number, but it's a population that has recovered from severe overexploitation over the past century, which is a good thing, I think. But of course, when people are looking at a short time frame, they see the population, they say it's exploding, and hence these calls for reducing it again.
Cheryl, you said that a reason why there hasn't been that many gray seals being culled or killed is because there's a lack of market for their products. Can you talk about how the seal, gray seal products, whatever you can get from them, are being marketed? What is being used from these gray seals, or are there proposals for products to be used? I think Alyssa was talking about something strange that I don't even remember. What are people using gray seals for?
Primarily for gray seals or any seals, we see their hunting is typically for the fur, right, which is used for luxury products, mitts and boots and coats. And
so even the gray seals as opposed to the harp seals, which have the beautiful white fur. So
gray seals as well. I think gray seals, there's been a lot of attempts to market the meat. Mm-hmm. Especially over
as with the harp seals,
and interestingly enough, in the Senate report here, some of the products that they talk about, you know, to try and get from gray seals, we're looking at things like pet food, seal oil, of course, for fat, omega-3, we see that one a lot, paint, leather, waterproof clothing. I mean, some of these, we're going to kill seals to make paint out of them, really, in this day and age? Some of them just made me shake my head.
It really seems like they're drawing at whatever they can. And just a question to follow up, are they still serving seal meat at the parliamentary restaurant in Ottawa?
They are not. And, you know, looked into it, that was a one-off.
Wasn't it a big seller?
It was a one-off deal. There was a senator, Senator Hervé Payette, had a special luncheon one day and invited all of the media and all of the politicians,
okay,
and they made this big show of, you know, all the seal meat, but it didn't actually make it onto the menu in the long term.
I bet there's a lot of disappointed consumers out there who are wishing they had their seal meat on the menu.
I saw the faces of some of the people tasting that.
I heard that seal meat actually, just as an aside, actually tastes really, really bad, so this is what I've heard.
I mean, I'll be honest, before, I'm vegetarian now, but before, I have tried seal meat.
Wow.
I know.
So
even so, you know, even when I ate meat, it's not something that, it's definitely an acquired taste. It's very strong and fishy and kind of like, to me, it was like fishy liver, which are probably two foods that I really can't stand. So mm-hmm. It's not something that a lot of people eat. We actually did a survey in Newfoundland sealing communities last year, and we found that even 33% of people in sealing communities never ate seal meat. So even in the region where it's sort of a cultural tradition, a lot of people aren't really eating it.
Mm. Well, so the plan then, or this recommendation, is to carry out this mass slaughter over 4 years, and I guess they're struggling to find markets for it. And is the plan to I read that this is sort of like an experiment, like they're planning on gathering data from this. Can you talk a bit about the science of it? And is this based on previous call success in other countries, perhaps?
Well, the big problem is there is no science to it. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the major criticisms from the scientists at Dalhousie, was that you can't conduct this sort of a call as an experiment. It's just impossible to do in a scientific sense. And, of course, we know that the Japanese whalers also use science as the basis for their killing of whales program, scientific whaling. So I think it's a very loose use of the term experiment that the government's using here. And interestingly, to look at the science that has been done and the things the research that's been done with culls in the past. A paper was released just this past year, co-authored by a Department of Fisheries scientist, ironically, that looked at examples of predator control around the world, our attempts to kill predators in order to reduce populations of their prey. And it found that, by and large, even in situations where we've reduced marine mammal populations by 50 to 80%, in almost all cases, there were either unknown or no effects on fish stocks. So even if you take out 80% of the seals in the ocean, you could have no effect on the fish stock. So the main idea here is that we don't know enough about how marine ecosystems work to predict what might happen with a cull. Removing such a large number of top predators could actually have a negative effect on cod. It could have an effect opposite to what the politicians are telling us it could happen. Gray seals eat other fish, such as herring, that are also predators of cod. So by reducing seals, you'd get greater numbers of this middle predator, which could, you know, further prohibit the recovery of cod. So it's just we're just tinkering with the ocean ecosystem with really no idea of what the outcome might be.
Yeah, that was one interesting fact I saw, was that, like, I would expect that the main staple of the gray seal's diet would be cod, but it actually doesn't appear to be.
Actually, very little, less than 7%, I think.
Wow.
You know, it's very little. I mean, gray seals eat a wide variety of things. And the other thing that, you know, it's kind of picks at me is that they've only looked at gray seal predation. Like, there's no question that the cod stock in this area is endangered. It's in trouble. But the Department of Fisheries has only looked really at seals as being a factor in the lack of recovery, and, you know, recommending a cull of seals. No one's looking at, you know, ocean oil and gas exploration and how this might be affecting recovery. No one's looking at the unreported catch from different fisheries of cod that's still going on in these areas and affecting recovery.
The human predators.
Yeah. And, you know, until we start getting our own activities under control, I think we're in no business trying to go and reduce populations of other animals. You know, this is a cod stock that, you know, a lot of people, I think, still are under this belief that there's been a cod moratorium for the past 20 years. That's not entirely true. A lot of these stocks have been opened up for commercial fisheries over the years. And the Southern Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is the one sort of being focused on here, has been opened at least for most of the past decade to commercial fisheries.
Wow.
You know, it's closed now. But, you know, as long as we're opening commercial fisheries against the scientific advice, again, we've learned nothing from the cod collapse in 1992, continuing to open commercial fisheries against scientific advice, and then we turn around and blame seals, I mean, that just doesn't fly with me. Sorry.
It doesn't really make sense. Yeah, I was really surprised to learn that. Like, I don't know much about what's going on over there, but I had assumed there was a moratorium and that the fish stocks were maybe slowly returning, but I wasn't aware that people still were allowed to catch up to, like, over 3,500 pounds. Or is that still happening right now, or not?
There is some catch right now, but I think it's mostly bycatch from other fisheries.
Right.
But as you say, there are some stocks where cod are returning, and ironically, those are the ones. Actually, one of the ones that they think is recovering is where the largest biomass of gray seals is, near Sable Island. That's where 80% of the gray seal population is. This is a stock that they think they're starting to see signs of recovery. It's also a stock that has not been open to commercial fishing for the past 20 years. So, you know, is it the seals or is it us?
I think it's pretty clear who knows, yeah.
And yeah. Jackie had asked my co-host. She was curious about how, since most people sort of understand that the lack of fish there has been due to overfishing, what's the public reactions to this Senate committee's recommendations?
I guess I can't really judge for the general public. I think the report has been, you know, widely welcomed by the fishing community, of course, because they've been calling for calls for a number of years now. The scientific community seems to have come out against it, again, with the marine biologists at Dalhousie making some fairly strong statements about this tinkering with ecosystems that could actually make things worse. And we're still waiting to see. We haven't heard anything from Fisheries Minister Gail Shea. It's presuming that since she requested this study be done that she would proceed with the call. But I think it's up to Canadians now to sort of put the pressure back on the Harper government and urge them to listen to the scientific advice and warn them that this is, you know, if you want to call this experiment, it's a very dangerous and risky experiment. And it's, you know, it's going to be expensive, too. We're going to be paying people to kill seals. It's, you know, at a time when we're cutting support, government support for other projects, how can we justify spending millions of dollars on a risky, scientifically unsupported cull of gray seals? It's just throwing money away to try and win votes for the next election, as far as I'm concerned.
Interesting. And I guess that's been going on for a long time. It's about the Conservatives wanting the, or Liberals, actually. It's not just the Conservatives wanting the Atlantic vote. Is that really what it comes down to here?
It's definitely got no scientific basis. So as far as I can see, this is just, you know, pure politics. It's appeasing.
Same as the Harp Seal call.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Tobin made it very clear that it was very big vote winner for him, you know, when he started opening up the Harp Seal hunt and increasing the quotas and subsidizing the seal hunt. And ever since then, politicians have kind of jumped on this wagon that supporting the killing of seals, no matter how, you know, wasteful of taxpayer dollars or how unnecessary, seems to be a good way to get votes from Eastern Canada. But, you know, at this day and age, I think we don't need seal products. There's no market for seal products. We're just paying to kill animals just for the politicians' benefit. It's gotten to the point of ridiculousness.
Mm-hmm. So writing letters to newspapers, contacting your MP, what else can we do to help stop this call from happening?
I would say absolutely contacting the MP, getting the word out, making people aware that it's going, you know, it could be happening. It's not scientifically supported. We do have a spot on our website. If I can put in a quick pitch, it's ifa.org/grayseals. And people can send a message directly to the minister from there, urging them not to support this seal call. I think there is still time that we can put pressure on the fisheries minister to keep this thing from happening.
Good, good. Well, thanks for shedding light on that. There's also an excellent video that we'll post on our blog, an animated video made by IFAW that I think is great and needs to get out there about this issue. Thanks for your time today, Cheryl.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show on 100.5 FM Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next week on the show, we'll have some special programming in honor of International Human Rights Day, which falls on December 10th. Our show is just a few days before that. We'll be doing a segment where we'll be discussing human rights and how they relate to animal rights. And we'll also have a feature interview with Don Moncrieff, the executive director of the organization A Well-Fed World, to speak about the correlation between human hunger and animal agriculture. I encourage you to keep connected with us at Animal Voices by going on our website, where you can download all our past shows, animalvoices.org. You can also find our shows on iTunes. Connect with us on Facebook. Animal Voices Vancouver is where you'll find our Facebook group there. And we're on Twitter as well, Animal Voices YVR. So there's lots of ways to keep in touch with us. And we do have an email address if you want to send us any suggestions or comments about the show at any time, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. So coming up next is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, but before that we're going to leave you with a song called Van City Blues by Risa. She's a local Vancouver vegan artist and healer. This is from her album R&B. Thank you for tuning in today and listening to the show, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Rich in spirit, sound in mind, but to my name I ain't got a dime. I got those Van City blues. It's been dark and gray, it seems to me like every single day. I got those Van City blues. Everybody in this bitty city has been with everybody else, yet still I can't have just one man to myself. I got those Van City blues. in spirit, sound in mind. But to my name, I ain't got a dime. I got those Van City blues. When it rains, it pours. I feel as cold inside as on the shore. I got those Van City blues. As blue as the mountains look, as blue as the sea would be. So blue, blue. Ba-do-ba-ba-da-ba-dee-da-ba-do. Ba-do-ba-ba-dee-da-ba-dee-da-ba-do. Ba-do-do-do. Ba-da-ba-dee-doo.